Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Symmetry of Soul, an ongoing endeavor to grasp the Urantia Papers in a synthetic wholeness. Tonight, paper 172, section 5. It's our arc. Jesus culminates his ministry. The fool says in his heart, there is no God. They are corrupt. Their deeds are vile. The Lord looks down from heaven on all mankind to see if there are any who understand, any who seek God. Do all these evildoers know nothing? Another one from the Psalms. I'm Brad Garner. So glad that you're here with us live or in our archive at symmetryofsoul.org. All of our past episodes are there for your inspection and edification. It's our usual crew this evening, Dr. Chris Halverson, Andrea Barnes, Carmen Anderson, and of course, you're here. We're glad that you're here. Please call up this marvelous text however you see fit, the Urantia Papers, and settle in for us for 2 hours of focused study. Evening, Dr. Chris.
Good evening, Brad. Yep, another great psalm there. Yes, one certainly has the free will to ignore the existence of God. However, in the spirit of our philosophic text that we're studying, it wouldn't be wise.
And it would be foolish, yeah.
Yes, it would. As Brad was saying, we're going to engage an interesting section this evening that is a little mini parallel to the 12 Apostles paper that we read not that long ago on this broadcast, and in relative terms, we've been at this thing for many, many years now. So, a few years is relatively not so long ago. they give us a little apostle by apostle breakdown of how each of them are faring emotionally in the wake of the so-called triumphant entry into Jerusalem. It's going to be an interesting exercise in psychology, and as usual, the midwayers try to challenge us to think as precisely physically about the nature of mind, the nature of the soul, the nature of our will. So we'll get into some details again too tonight. I should make sure I say hello to you, Andrea, and you, Kermit, and everyone listening. Didn't want to diss you there. Great to have you all with us as usual.
All right. Thank you, Chris. We're really looking forward to it as always. This is another one of those sections that's easy reading on the surface, you know, some decent characterization. But to go a little bit deeper with it, to not just deal with just the vivid portraits, but to see what are the truths flowing through this. How is it relevant to us? That's something you always help us with tremendously here, and we are grateful. Andrea, good evening to you. How's everything out your way?
Everything's going really well, Brad. I'm glad to be here tonight. I'm looking forward to tonight's study. I always like reflecting on the apostles and how what they were learning and living, how they lived with Jesus and how that impacted them and who they were as human beings. It's so fascinating.
Yeah, it really is. I enjoy the very same thing. I actually dusted off a little private spreadsheet I made a few years ago, and I've been adding to over time about the 12 apostles. I know, analytic mind, I'm trying to control that because one of the apostles was prone to doing too much of that, but it was helpful to compare that.
Yeah.
We'll see where it takes us. And Kermit, good evening to you. How are you doing, and what can you tell us about last week's show?
Well, good evening, Brad and Chris and Andrea and the chat room and switchboard. And I also dusted off my spreadsheet on the apostles and added that last column about their response to the entry into Jerusalem. So don't feel like the Lone Ranger. Now, last week, a Symmetry of Soul host mentioned his gratitude for the visual aids available in the TV series The Chosen, which give color and vividness to the narrative of Jesus' story. In particular, the series depicts the Jewish people's focus on religious living through incidental behaviors throughout their daily living and exhibition of familiarity with their scriptures. By today's comparison, self-proclaimed religionists have lost the religious focus of putting God first in their lives for others to see. By their fruits, you will know them. True religion is wholehearted devotion and a living loyalty to some reality which the religionist deems to be of supreme value for himself and for all mankind. A question arose as to the distinction between such wholehearted devotion and the faintest flicker of faith to which the Father will ever respond. This led to a discussion of the aspects of quantity and quality in the realms of religion. Faintest flickers are not much quantitatively, but the quality of an honest attempt of a fearful soul to reach out for the Father represents a genuine faith nucleus he honors and fosters, and around which a sphere of righteousness can grow. But mistake not, those who have been called out of the darkness are expected to believe with a whole heart. Tonight's reading, that was last week's reading, tonight's reading about the Palm Sunday welcoming crowd will speak to the quantity-quality issue. The bias towards quantity today can be traced to the birth of scientific inquiry in the Enlightenment. The corresponding reduction in quality of religious living evinced by the rise of materialism and secularism is the milieu into which the fifth epical revelation is delivered. The ability of the fifth epical revelation to uplift civilization is dependent on its reception by enough individuals who are upliftable. Note the fate of the Jews, who it turns out were not upliftable, resulting in forfeiture of their role as the spiritual standard bearers of the world. We began our reading in section 3 of paper 172, The Start for Jerusalem. Scrutiny of the gospel records illuminated by the midway disclosures throughout part 4 allow for the coordination of essential knowledge. The advanced student of the revelation will surely undertake to compare the gospel accounts of the midway narrative reflectively for a truthful synthesis of the master's bestowal. Symmetry of Soul will continue to point out instances of such notable coordination, leaving the details for the student to pursue. Jesus had always sought to suppress all public acclaim of him as the Messiah. In his considerations regarding his public entrance into Jerusalem, now, being at the end of his ministry in the flesh, he loosened his constraints in such matters and saw no harm in allowing his disciples to freely express their feelings. But to be clear, Jesus' decisions on his manner of entry into Jerusalem were not made for the purpose of satisfying the expectations of others. He knew what awaited him in Jerusalem and chose to live out his bestowal in obedience to the Father's will and in conformity with the cosmos. Jesus chose to enter Jerusalem in consonance with the scripture Zechariah 9:9, oft-times associated with the Messiah. He would enter peacefully and with goodwill, riding on a donkey and not as the bold and aggressive temporal deliverer successor of David, as described in other messianic prophecies. Jesus was hardly successful in conveying the spiritual nature of the kingdom of heaven to his apostles and disciples. But this was certainly not due to shortcomings on his part, rather that his hearers were so materially minded and unable to rise above their preconceived opinions, settled ideas, and long-standing prejudices to grasp such a concept. It was an enthusiastic and festive crowd of several hundred that set out from Bethany. Another several thousand Passover visitors to Jerusalem, having been notified by David Zebedee and some of his men acting on their own initiative, set out to meet the procession from Bethany. The two groups met as Jesus had passed over the Brow of Olivet. It was at the Brow of Olivet that Jesus' demeanor changed. He wept as he addressed the city, pronouncing the destruction of Jerusalem as the terrible consequences of their rejection of the Son of Peace, echoing the prophet Jeremiah's description of the destruction of the first temple in Lamentations. As the two groups met, Pharisees coming out from Jerusalem chided Jesus, urging him to control the cheering multitude. Jesus replied, "It is only fitting that these children should welcome the Son of Peace, whom the chief priests have rejected. It would be useless to stop them, lest in their stead these stones by the roadside cry out." Was Jesus suggesting that should the Pharisees squelch the crowd, God himself could raise up stones in praise of the Son of Man? Or was he alluding to the possibility of the crowd stoning the Pharisees in response to their attempts at quieting them? The crowd's joyous welcome of the Master did not run deep. Later this same week, when Jesus did not live up to the messianic expectations, the same crowds were willing to reject him. Strong emotion is hardly equivalent to deep conviction, let alone living faith. The final section of our reading that last week, visiting about the temple, section 4. Upon arriving at the temple, Jesus and the apostles, minus the Alpheus twins, who were returning the donkey to its owner, strolled about the temple observing the Passover preparations. This day was unprecedented in the lives of the thoughtful but speechless apostles. Here we find the well-known story of the widow's mite, illustrating the contrast between the wholehearted and unquestioning widow who in her religious devotion gave all in her contribution to the temple treasury, and the rich who gave from their superfluity what amounted to a trifle. Strolling about the temple courts, Jesus silently reflected on his emotions in connection with previous visits and then led the company back to Bethany for the night. And we will find out tonight what their responses and reflections were. And here ends the summary.
Thank you so much, Kermit. Looking forward to what we come up with tonight for sure, but thank you for reminding us where we were last week. That was all very helpful. I liked how you summarized our discussion before we started the reading, and I like how you finished with the widow's mite. It's a thought that I had on my mind, but maybe I'll bring that up in a minute. Let me see first, anything on anyone else's mind? Anything to clarify? Thoughts?
Just one little quick technical issue. I didn't hyper-emphasize it last week, but I tried to indicate in passing. When I was referring to Jesus's lament there about, oh, Jerusalem, and how that harkens back, it harkens back directly to the statements of Jeremiah in the book of Jeremiah, the book entitled Jeremiah, some O Jerusalems there, in particular. And then tradition has it that the book of Lamentations was written by Jeremiah, but that's not definitive. You have the entirety of the book of Lamentations, regardless of author, that it's certainly hearkening back to, as a lament, and then some definite, direct statements by Jeremiah, in that book. Just to clear that up, make sure that people understand that, we aren't saying that we definitively know that Lamentations was written by Jeremiah. But
yeah, thanks for the clarification. Did you mention, was that also, Chris, you mentioned that Lamentations is traditionally read at that Western Wall, the Wailing Wall in Jerusalem this day?
Still to this day, we'll stand there and read the entire book of Lamentations.
Cheerful. But, okay. I mean, it's worth remembering, lest history repeat itself, I guess. There's a lot of reasons for that.
One can take it out of the immediate context of the roller coaster relationship of the Hebrew people to God, you know, as recorded in the Old Testament, you know, and the specific issues with Jerusalem. But again, you know, just harkening to the psalm that you read up front, right, like I said, you can ignore the existence of God. You have the free will to do that, and especially in this day and age, there's all kinds of human sophistication that you can convince yourself or try to convince yourself fill the God void in your soul. But right, it's never wise to try to base your life as if God didn't exist. You know, and that's a lesson that comes out of the Old Testament, you know, regardless of this, you know, like I said, the specifics of it to the Jewish people and Palestine and whatnot, and modifications to the actual history, you know, that's all secondary to the fact that it's still true. Right? It's never wise, you know, to base your life on our desires and the instructions that we come up with based upon our desires.
Yeah.
You need to base your life on God's instructions.
I just to tell a quick story here, you don't need to comment or anything, but I was at a house the other day, and there was a woman watching some comedy special on TV, and the woman was making all these really, I don't even know how to put it, just such rank jokes, and really getting, trying to make jokes about abortion. And she even said, well, I'm sure this isn't a God-sharing group. This is a godless group. Am I right? And people in the audience cheered, and I thought, wow, that's just beyond anything I could imagine that people would cheer about being godless.
We've all been, as a society, been backed into this, this supposedly sophisticated intellectual notion, that religion and God and all that stuff is just merely primitive superstition. If it was just primitive superstition, right, there would be a point. Okay, but there is a real God. And no one exists unless they really are godlike.
Yep.
So, who will have the last laugh?
Twentieth century secularism tends to affirm that man does not need God.
Yeah.
The famous disaster paragraph in paper 195. Yes.
Yeah. And, all the times that we basically, talk about this, every time Jesus brings up salvation, he didn't come to just bring the message that God is a God of love. He came to bring the gospel of salvation. All right? I mean, we don't want to ever lose sight of what I just said a second ago. I mean, there is no reality apart from God, no matter how much you delusionally think there is, and no matter how much it appears that your life is pleasant, even though you don't base it on the existence of God. Right? I mean, it's only the grace of God that gives you that illusion that you can base your life apart from God and it still is pleasant.
Yeah, that reminds me of a sermon I heard recently where he was citing something else, I think an observation in a book somewhere. They said every human being has experienced the grace of God. You know, Hitler saw the mountains and had a pet dog, and he just lists these awful, evil historical figures who still experienced beauty in their lives and moments of grace in their lives. You can't help it. You cannot be fully separated from the grace of God while living in this life. You can, using your willpower, you can act as though you're separated from it, or as if you've just done it yourself somehow. But there are, every moment of the day is filled with grace that's not appreciated by the secular and the
You can, without any resistance against your absolutely sovereign free will, you're free to believe that beauty just magically springs out of the void. Right? But how little reflection is required to recognize that that's absurd. If there's beauty, there's God.
Yeah, it's a lesson that I feel like we could all learn as very young children around parents, you know. A very young child might naively think that the pantry just magically gets restocked with their favorite breakfast cereal. It's an infinite supply of food. But pretty quickly they learn that, no, this is the goodwill, the benevolence of their parents. You know, they put it in there, and they provide for them. So a child should be grateful, shouldn't just cross their arms and say, I don't need my parents. I mean, the pantry gives me all the food that I need. There's no need. No. Anyway.
Yeah. You mentioning the thankful, to think about that transcendent transition above prayer. It's one thing to begin to pray to a God to supply your needs, but to transcend that, and give thanks to the God that has given you all that you really need.
Yeah, get yourself out of the way. Yeah, start toward the being self-forgetting, not self-reminding, and in that Thanksgiving leading up to worship. Yeah.
Yes.
Well, when did atheism become so fashionable? And it hadn't been around. I mean, you could be killed for being an atheist back in the day, way back in the way day. So it's a fairly recent phenomenon. I guess it goes hand in glove with materialism, the rise of materialism, although materialism has been around a long time, too.
Yeah, and again, to even, just ask yourself kind of a deeper philosophic question, how, in any age, how could materialism ever have any credence? How could secularism, have any credence? The fancier man gets, the less it appears that he needs God, right? And that, that fundamentally what, makes us more susceptible to these sophistries is our own fanciness and our pride in it. It can be summed up as that ism, humanism.
All right. Yeah, as the measure of all things.
Yeah.
It has me thinking of that long list in paper 67, section 3, paragraph 6, of what allowed Van to be unmoved, unshaken, and how many in that list, clear thinking, wise reasoning, logical judgment, how many of those have been turned on their axis in today's age? I mean, if you have muddled thinking, if you have foolish reasoning, if you have illogical judgment, you will turn away from the universe that has God at its center.
Again, only when it takes some measure of human mind to identify with God. It may be that tiny little logical sphere that's around that faint flicker of faith. But nonetheless, right? I mean, if there wasn't some sort of little tiny logical sphere, right? I mean, that naked, nucleus of faith, wouldn't recognize the logic of the existence of God. faith in and of itself is not logic. Right? It's one of the threefold system of reason, logic, faith.
Right.
Yeah.
Right? And the very fact that, you know, I can analogize logic as a sphere around the faith nucleus, right, the superadditive consequence of the relationship between reason and faith, transcendently, is logic. Any valid analogy to understand the threefold system needs to directly present logic in a transcendent to faith way, right? The surrounding sphere relative to the faith nucleus, for instance. Appreciate that even that most humble and unlearned, right? The unlearned part means that there hasn't been much growth that's happened. But, you know, there is no growth involved in just the fiat establishment of your encirclement in the Holy Spirit. It establishes, superconsciously, a faith nucleus and the minimum surrounding sphere of logic and radii of reason within that sphere. Right? That's all given to you by grace, that initial fiat establishment, of something that could begin the process.
Yeah.
So grateful. Again, grateful. Otherwise, what hope would we really have? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, but like back to your point, Kermit. Humans get fancier. They can supply their needs, better because they have a little bit of scientific knowledge and some technology. They also can be befogged by much thinking. Something that most humble and unlearned child of God doesn't have to deal with.
That
the obvious twins were never befogged by much thinking.
that little saying that there is a way that seems right to a man, and that's what's happening with these atheists. They think, well, I can't possibly be a religionist. I wouldn't want to be stupid like that and, fall prey to that sort of superstitious thinking. They don't realize there's another approach, and it's just such a shame that it's like that.
Yeah, we've talked about this. It's one thing when we're talking about genuinely very primitive mentality, is kind of just fancy animal, and but when you can see that you have a mind that has a little bit more spiritualization, and will is in play some, and so you see literally them professing out loud a deliberate devotion to godless ideals, right? You can get to wickedness and still maybe not fully have it in that in that conscious modality of where you will consciously use the word godless, and nonetheless you are exhibiting a devotion to godless ideals, and there's wickedness there. But you've gone off the starting block of wickedness when you're getting to the point where it's becoming a very conscious thing, an ever more deliberate act of will. And the more that isn't aggressively eliminated from society like it used to be, the more it's given free rein, You know, if not, you know, worse is, you know, if anyone who speaks against it is accused of being intolerant, you know, which is a complete perversion of the word tolerance, saying that you should be tolerant of wickedness.
Right.
You know, so it, you know, we're in this modality, you know, where this ever more deliberately wicked society, you know, they're coming for people. And so it's taking on more and more of a feel of an Old Testament story. You know, and like I said a little bit ago, you can, you know, with the help of the fifth epical revelation, you can set aside, you know, the kind of reworking of history in the Old Testament that they help you to kind of recognize where that is and, you know, and whatnot. You know, but the truth of the Old Testament is, you know, stands unmoved by that, you know, historical corrective act. You know, and you know, it's a story of how wickedness plays out and how aggressive it is in wanting to absorb everything. And it goes for little children. You know, so, you know, as we've said many times on this broadcast, you know, the point isn't to always focus on the fact that it's an emergency revelation and this is in play, but you don't want to completely ever lose sight of it. Because if you know the book is a revelation, if you know it's real, you know that with each moment of passing time, you know, we're getting closer and closer to the actualization of why the book was given to us sort of in advance. Right? It was an impending emergency in fact. You know, it was an imminent one in truth, you know, over 100 years ago. Okay? But, you know, it wasn't fully manifest in fact yet 150 years ago. So, you know, we want to make sure that as we, you know, as Brad was saying up front, you know, as we study any of these historical stories, whether it's just 2,000 years ago or going back to Jeremiah or whatnot, you know, that we remember to recognize the truths there and how they apply to our situation today. You know, and the more that we go retrograde, you know, the more the Old Testament circumstance is valid than the New Testament circumstance.
Huh. Yeah, I actually find myself spending a fair bit of time thinking about the story of the Tower of Babel these days. That's probably a digression for a different time, but especially with the version restored to us in paper 77. You know, is it a tower about certain racial superiorities? Is it a tower about materialistic commerce, or is it a tower to God? Well, the God people were driven right out of town, and the other two obliterated each other. Like, huh, something about this feels familiar.
Yeah, I mean, you know, people need to ask themselves, the retrograde readers need to ask themselves, would you like to experience, you know, what it was like in society before there was any Jesus revelation influence in society?
Oh, that's a great thought.
You really want to go back to the Old Testament.
Yeah, right. Back to nature. Let's see. Let's try that on. Do you really want to double down on that? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, like Andrew was saying, I mean, there's a lot, you know, a lot of people and a growing number of people that very consciously, willfully, you know, want to eliminate any residual Jesus influence from our civilization. You know, and a lot, they've made a lot of progress, quote unquote, you know, in the last 50 years.
Well, that leads me into the comment I wanted to make that's been on my mind, I think. So This last weekend, I had an opportunity to deliver a talk to a group of readers at the Urantia Book, and it was more of just a personal testimony, of which Symmetry of Soul listeners have heard bits and pieces over the years. One theme I hit upon was that we are still swimming in the waters of our culture. You know, we are not separatists here. We use the water metaphor a fair bit. We talk about trying to be in our own little parallel stream, and there's wisdom, a great deal of wisdom in that. My point is, I grew up in a society that was, you know, in the 1980s, 1990s in America, trying to find ways to tear down religionists, to mock them, to say they're outmoded. And I went right along with it as a kid, as a teenager. And the reason it came up was we read about the widow's mite last week, which kind of made me think about tithing and how to this very day, even after so much restoration and grace in my life, I still have a very fraught relationship with the idea of tithing, of giving to a religious institution or a ministry of any kind, because, yes, I did see corrupt shaman-like men behaving badly around me, especially in Texas, the televangelist movement. We went to a church whose pastor eventually went to jail for tax fraud and extorted all kinds of money from the tribe. And it led me to be very cynical very early in my life. And to this day, every time I think about putting something in an offering plate, I wonder, well, how much of this is going to be spent on a private jet plane? It's so cynical, but it's just like baked into my cultural DNA, if that's not an oxymoron. But that's exactly what the mass culture would have wanted me to go along with, and I did. And now it's sort of ingrained, and I'm still having to unwind that.
We've all been miseducated, and that miseducation, doesn't just corrupt, the philosophic sphere. It's so mis, it's so wrong, that it penetrates all the way to the religious core of your being. There's a deep corruption that we unwittingly, marinate in our early years. The question is, how many people can still pull themselves out of that?
Right.
So that when all is said and done, it's not civilization destroying. I mean, obviously, the numbers are going to get fewer and fewer. And that's what the revelators tell us. Yeah, you can start with basically 100% religious society. But if a few decades hence it's 95%, and then a few decades hence it's 90%, and just connect the dots. Right? And when it gets to 50%, you're in serious jeopardy. And if it gets to 25%, you're done.
Yeah.
There will still be religionists in each generation, but more and more these days, it seems that I count myself as one of them. If God will let me, I'm a religionist who carries scars, who tells a story of wrecking himself on the rocks of the wider culture around. And only in my darkest hour did I find, enough of a nucleus to pray and begin to come back. There are a lot of religionists walking around with those kinds of scars that I guess people wouldn't have gathered in the same way in a more overtly religious society. Religionists are still here, but they had to work. They had to struggle to retain their religious or gain back their religious nucleus.
And just kind of to wrap it up and kind of bring it back around to our reading tonight. We're studying what happened 2,000 years ago with Jesus of Nazareth, and you can. If nothing else, you can keep in mind that if you live in the United States, or countries in the world that have benefited indirectly from the existence of the United States. And the United States could never, ever have existed if Jesus hadn't come 2,000 years ago. He changed things so that eventually 2,000 years hence, you could have the founding fathers of the United States. And they could hold truths to be self-evident. As we've pointed out many times, one of the divine ideals that Jesus injected into the human system was the preeminence of the individual. If that hadn't entered our bloodstream in some way, you could have never founded a country based upon the preeminence of the individual. No one would have ever even thought of that. That's a revelation. Right, and we see it more and more. Those who, have no identification to Jesus or even God, they don't think, it's obvious you should base it on the preeminence of the individual. No, what's naturally, quote-unquote, obvious is you should base it on, human collectives. Right? It should be external-based, not internal-based. External-based, centralized, collectivist schemes. It's centralized because of material pragmatism. Right? And it's external-based, collectivist. It's the direct opposite of internal-based preeminence of the individual.
Yeah, and there's a time in primitive society where that is good, where that's appropriate, because the individuals are not mature enough to handle individuality. But to see a civilization that gained that and then to fall back to those older patterns is, I suppose, tragic. But that's what we're looking at.
It's also kind of historic. It was the third attempt at mammals that succeeded.
Right. So it goes.
Yeah. Republic, if you can keep it.
Yeah.
Mammals, if you can keep them. Yeah, on a decimal world. Okay, there we go.
On a decimal world, it's like, no, it's not going to be kept the first two times. It's going to fall through the cracks. I bring that up just to remind everyone that, everything is one system. Right? If you find a truth, it can be seen manifesting across the entire system from matter through mind and into spirit. The entire thing is one true system. The same basic truths drive the whole system.
It's the only reason anything is actually comprehensible, truly understandable, is that that it's patterned.
We're even though it seems like we're far afield, we're setting up the philosophic space to not just read section 5 here in paper 172 as just a historical recitation, blah, 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 blah. But to put all the words in an insightful space, right, and see into the truth of what's there.
Well, let's get going.
Okay.
We're in paper 172 of the Urantia Papers, Going into Jerusalem. This is Section 5, The Apostles' Attitude, on page 1883, if you've got a single-column publication book. This Sunday evening, as they returned to Bethany, Jesus walked in front of the apostles. Not a word was spoken until they separated after arriving at Simon's house. No 12 human beings ever experienced such diverse and inexplicable emotions as now surged through the minds and souls of these ambassadors of the kingdom. These sturdy Galileans were confused and disconcerted. They did not know what to expect next. They were too surprised to be much afraid. They knew nothing of the master's plans for the next day, and they asked no questions. They went to their lodgings, though they did not sleep much, save the twins, but they did not keep armed watch over Jesus at Simon's house.
Yeah, to be fuddled, to be afraid there. The first thing to notice is the title, right? And what's missing? It seems like there's an S missing from the end. Shouldn't it be the Apostles' Attitudes?
Oh.
But it's singular. Attitude. And especially when you start reading, and it says diverse.
Yeah.
Yeah, so shouldn't it be attitudes? Yeah, scientifically it would be a plural, but you read on, right, these 30 Galileans were confused and disconcerted. Yeah, singular, right? You know, they're all in the same philosophic space.
Mm-hmm.
They all have the same singular attitude just completely unable to bring their minds to much of a focus. You know, for various
reasons. Interesting. It's just a single letter change. I wouldn't have noticed that, Chris. One S.
Yeah. So diverse, yes, right? But so we're looking for what they all have in common on the one hand, and then also how it varies from temperament to temperament, and we can already kind of guess. I wonder if Peter, James, John, and Simon Zelotes, might have big issues.
Stay tuned.
Yeah, you know what some of the diversity that's coming is to the degree to which the psychology of these apostles, like the fifth epistle of Revelation allows you to know. To notice that there's a common issue that they none of them at least fully had psychologically, encompassing that philosophically, what it takes to deal with a situation that is in just complete defiance of your preconceived opinions, settled ideas, and longstanding prejudices.
Yeah.
They're all on lines, like we've talked about many times, and Jesus has been trying to get them off these lines, forever with basically no success. They're still on the lines, when it becomes painfully apparent that those lines don't go anywhere, guys, instead of going, "Whoa, I think I've just, reduced my initial assumption to an absurdity and I need to philosophically start from the beginning again." No, you don't get that response. You basically just get, Right.
One of the challenges, it seems, of the animal origin nature is that when it's placed under stress of intense kind, like they would be feeling here, Jesus is predicting his own death and all is not well, the animal in us reverts back to earlier, more primitive forms of coping or
right.
Interpreting or thinking. And that was something that was on my mind as I dusted off my spreadsheet that talked about the general temperament of the apostles from paper 139. Despite years in the personal presence of Jesus, at this moment, how much do they resemble that essential temperament that's described of them? Maybe at their best, they were exhibiting some spiritual growth, some actual development, but under stress here, they're reverting back to older forms.
And again, to just notice the midway selection of this of this singular attitude, philosophic singular attitude, confused and disconcerted. Yeah, you know, so, you know, the disconcerted, you know, they've literally been knocked off of their lines of expectation. And you know, and everything is all just melted together. Yeah, it's confused in their minds. Right? They can't bring anything to a focus. So, you know, it, you know, like I said, that's what, you know, most of us need, you know, in order to finally be driven back to our initial assumptions and change something, you know, essential to having a different course with our life. You know, you have to sort of just reach this point where, you know, sort of everything, you know, melts together so that there's no sort of separation, you know, of locations in your mind. It all is just one homogeneous melt, and you know, and all of your lines that you thought you were on, all just, you know, you're knocked off of all of those, and you just have nothing. You have nothing in place or direction left. That's the thing about confused and disconcerted. It's basically place and direction. You have nothing in place and direction left. You know, and either you just, you know, go catatonic, or maybe you, you know, step back from yourself and reconsider something very fundamental about what you've been assuming about reality.
Well, yeah, I guess that was my point of the. So, you know, the animal origin, you know, our biology and everything, our psychology will take us back to that point. But then what will you do in the face of it? Will you just go catatonic in your primitive coping mechanisms, or will you take a step outside of yourself and say something isn't working here and have that, you know, dark night of the soul, and then in humility allow something to nucleate within you that is on a firmer foundation?
Yeah, the one other thing that I wanted to point out here, because it's an important element that they're putting in up front here, you know, since we're constantly looking for the physics that's, you know, that's woven into all these statements, you notice when it says such diverse and inexplicable emotions, okay, if you've been following along in our, you know, with these broadcasts, you know, you get that far and you think, oh, emotions, okay, lower domain, you know, level of the feelings, and they're very strong, so it actually has a physiological manifestation. It's not just merely a feeling. But then it says, as now surge through the minds, and you're still okay, but then it says, and souls.
Yeah.
Of these ambassadors of the kingdom. And there's a you know a very straightforward example of, see, by mind there you mean the lower domain, and by soul you mean the upper domain in the hourglass analogy. We're not literally talking about the Marantxa mindful self here. Okay. So you're literally invoking, see, the hourglass analogy, minds and souls, you know, lower domain, upper domain. And see, the fact that you know that the emotions innately aren't in the upper domain. They aren't saying somehow you've put emotions in the upper domain. These emotions are so strong, they not only see are impacting downward to your body, right? So that, you know, they're literally an emotion, they're not merely a feeling. But your sixth adjutant, your religious impulse is being so stimulated there on the level of the feelings, right, that it's, you know, there's an impulse that's directed upward. You know, you're spiritualizing an essence of those emotions, and it's disrupting your inner life. It's disrupting your soul.
supposed to have a guard set to where your inner life isn't tossed about by those outer life emotions, but that's not happening here.
When things get really strong on the second level, of, you know, the level of the feelings there, see, like you're saying, to recognize that, you know, you can't do anything about how it may make your hands quiver. But you can do something about whether or not that's broadcast, you know, the unity of it is broadcast upward, you know, and that's not a cosmic unity. It's a, you know, it's a self-circumscribed unity, which will disrupt the cosmic unity in the upper domain. It injects evil into that space. Self-disrupting. See, so, I mean, it's one thing for, you know, the self-confusing, as they're mentioning, see, about confused and disconcerted. Okay, but see, to point out, yeah, but it's so strong. You know, you're in a modality where, you know, at the very least, you're going to have a short-term need to reestablish some integrity in that upper domain. And if you're someone like one of these apostles, right, it's going to play into an already disintegrating upper domain. As we'll see when we get to Mr. Judas.
Okay, onward. We're going to actually rotate through the reading a little bit as we go through each apostle, but I'll lead off here with Andrew. Andrew was thoroughly bewildered, well-nigh confused. He was the one apostle who did not seriously undertake to evaluate the popular outburst of acclaim. He was too preoccupied with the thought of his responsibility as chief of the apostolic corps to give serious consideration to the meaning or significance of the loud hosannas of the multitude. Andrew was busy watching some of his associates, who he feared might be led away by their emotions during the excitement, particularly Peter, James, John, and Simon Zelotes. Throughout this day and those which immediately followed, Andrew was troubled with serious doubts, but he never expressed any of these misgivings to his apostolic associates. He was concerned about the attitude of some of the 12 who he knew were armed with swords, but he did not know that his own brother Peter was carrying such a weapon. And so the procession into Jerusalem made a comparatively superficial impression upon Andrew. He was too busy with the responsibilities of his office to be otherwise affected.
Okay. So a number of little themes here. Okay, the overarching one, though, I mean, you know, is because Andrew, you know, not only his temperament, but, you know, his commitment to his office is so focused on, you know, a lot of outer life administrative concerns. I mean, he has so much material pragmatism in play that it's beneficial in this circumstance. It's mitigating, you know, the runaway idealism, you know, issues and stuff, right? Getting out of control. You know, notice that he was, you know, it was enough to temper it so he was only well nigh confused. Right? Not fully
right.
Confused, right? His impact was comparatively superficial, right? It's a comparatively superficial impression. You know, it didn't penetrate as deeply into the upper domain. That's what they mean by superficial. And it didn't penetrate as deeply into the upper domain with disruptive consequences as it did for others.
What do you think his doubts were about? Not about...
But yeah, I was going to get to that in just a second here.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
But, before we do that, just, you know, notice the, you know, Andrew's fearing that those four, yeah, I said I was hinting at the beginning. I wonder if those volatile four might have issues. Yeah, fear that they might be led away by their emotions. Right? And see, and again, like I was trying to set up, the Midwayers did, see, with minds and souls. Right? Don't just think led away in their outer life, but led away in their inner life. Right? Now, and see, and you know, that's the real concern here. Being led away in your outer life has a natural material friction that damps things out. I'm going to run 100 miles an hour forever. No, you're going to run out of gas in short order. Right? But your inner life, like we were talking about last week, right? It's a superfluid. There's no friction. Right? That the more spiritualized that domain is, the less friction there is. And so you can, be led away very rapidly and very far in your inner life if you're not careful. Now to your point, Andrea, on the one hand, there's this tempering of his material pragmatism so that it's superficial and just well nigh and those sorts of things. However, right, you're noticing it's comparatively superficial, right? Yeah, it actually penetrated into his inner life. Andrew was troubled with serious doubts,
right.
First stage evil.
Yeah, I wouldn't have expected that from him.
Yeah, see, you wouldn't expect it from him, but see, it's such an extreme situation that even Andrew, right, spiritualized this to the point of self-disruption, right, in the initial stages in his inner life, doubt. And you can see that, right, as they continue on, but he never expressed any of these misgivings.
Misgivings.
Miss. The prefix means wrong.
Yeah.
There's literal evil. Right? That doubt. I mean, it's serious doubts, right, even. Okay. If you already had first stage evil there, right? Yeah. Maybe it'd push you to second stage evil. Right? If you didn't have first stage evil there, it would establish first stage evil there. I mean, these very strong upward impulses that are predicated on the limitations of yourself. So they're framed by yourself, not the cosmos. Right? Cosmic unity is good. See, a self unity is disrupting of the cosmic unity. It's evil.
Huh. Self unity.
Right. As I was saying, I mean, that sixth adjutant, see, that's a unity-like adjutant there on the second level of meaning. It's going to take the unity essence, the continuumness of your current state of mind down there, propel it upward. Try to make the upper domain framed by yourself rather than by the cosmos. Right? For the continuumness foundation up there to be self-based and not cosmic-based.
And that's what happens with the secularist.
Yeah, that's what happens. When we talk about when you talk about spiritualizing things, see, this is what we're talking about. See, you say, well, spiritualizing, that's got to be good. No, not if it's based on self and not the cosmos.
Yeah.
Okay. Then it's the opposite. Unity based on the self is evil. Unity based on the cosmos is good.
Right.
Right.
It's that double-edged sword.
Spirit is not innately divine. Right.
Right.
Yes. Right.
Right. That same issue. Right. And so to put a watch on, when the lower domain gets boiling, right, you need to put a watch on your soul. Right? Because your sixth Sagittarius is indiscriminate. It's going to try to project, right, the unity essence of what of that boiling domain down there up into the upper domain.
Oh, we've got an example of it coming up here.
Yeah. Yeah. So just to notice that even Andrew had misgivings, wrong givings.
Hmm.
It was wrong to give what he gave to his inner life.
Okay. All right.
So this is not an instructive tale. It's a cautionary tale, even for Andrew. I mean, all the more if the outer life, if you are too preoccupied with your responsibilities in your outer life to give serious consideration to your inner life, that's trouble. Something will be happening there anyway. You've got to mind the set of guards.
Yeah. But, on the other hand, again, like I pointed out, he was, he had so much identified to the material pragmatism that it did temper the negative consequences some. Right? So, it reminds you of why God made the material boat anchor around your ankles so big. It's for your own safety.
It retards dangerous velocities, yeah.
Yes.
right.
Exactly. Yes.
Okay. Simon Peter was at first almost swept off his feet by this popular manifestation of enthusiasm, but he was considerably sobered by the time they returned to Bethany that night. Peter simply could not figure out what the master was about. He was terribly disappointed that Jesus did not follow up this wave of popular favor with some kind of a pronouncement. Peter could not understand why Jesus did not speak to the multitude when they arrived at the temple, or at least permit one of the apostles to address the crowd. Peter was a great preacher, and he disliked to see such a large, receptive, and enthusiastic audience go to waste. He would so much have liked to preach the gospel of the kingdom to that throng right there in the temple, but the master had specifically charged them that they were to do no teaching or preaching while in Jerusalem this Passover week. The reaction from the spectacular procession into the city was disastrous to Simon Peter. By night, he was sobered and inexpressibly saddened. Poor guy.
Notice how many dis, words are in play.
He got dissed.
Disconcerted.
Disaster.
Disastrous. Right. Disappointed. Right, this means apart, and literally, bifurcated, based on, the number two, the dis prefix. Yes. So you're broken in two and set apart from, whatever, right? It's modifying. In the case of disastrous, mm-hmm. It's apart from the stars, right? In other words, it's apart from the cosmos.
What about disappointed?
Yeah, and then that appointed. See, so, like I said, that whole bit of, disconcerted, they all have, sort of a line that they're imagining along it, and just, visualize, holding up your index finger, and looking down that line and going, we're going to that point right there. Right, but you're knocked apart from that point, disappointed. See, what you're pointing to, you're knocked apart from that. Okay, see, and it's all this. See, it's all their self-based expectations. Right, this giant wrecking ball is hitting them. you know, at right angles to that line that they're looking down and knocking them off that line.
Oh, that's interesting, yeah.
Okay. The literalness of what, you know, to visualize there. And, you know, in that regard, so you have, you know, this disappointment, this disillusionment. I mean, that's, you know, kind of universal amongst all the 12. And, you know, but think about how, you know, once, as they're pointing out here, first of all, with Peter, you know, once the immediacy, you know, of that disillusionment, that disappointment fades, you settle into some benighted state. Right? And, you know, it's the last word in this paragraph about Peter. Inexpressibly saddened. So, you know, immediately he's disappointed, you know, all of his grand thoughts, you know, and plans and schemes and imaginings, okay, he's knocked off of that, and, you know, and he's frustrated by that and everything, okay, but then, you know, that all sort of just, you know, fades, slips through his fingers, and he's left just inexpressibly sad. Okay. Right. So that sort of psychological darkness, right, that you then descend into and closes around you. You know, and we'll see if we have any signs of what the remedy is for that as we continue to read.
To James Zebedee, this Sunday was a day of perplexity and profound confusion. He could not grasp the purport of what was going on. He could not comprehend the master's purpose in permitting this wild acclaim and then in refusing to say a word to the people when they arrived at the temple. As the procession moved down Olivet toward Jerusalem, more especially when they were met by the thousands of pilgrims who poured forth to welcome the master, James was cruelly torn by his conflicting emotions of elation and gratification at what he saw and by his profound feeling of fear as to what would happen when they reached the temple. And then was he downcast and overcome by disappointment when Jesus climbed off the donkey and proceeded to walk leisurely about the temple courts. James could not understand the reason for throwing away such a magnificent opportunity to proclaim the kingdom. By night, his mind was held firmly in the grip of a distressing and dreadful uncertainty.
There's another distressing. Again, not all of these apart from, you know, their preconceived opinions, settled ideas, and longstanding prejudices, all those subjective, self-based, you know, expectations and lines. Knocked off of those. Okay, so now, see, notice in contrast to Peter, I mean, you know, instead of, you know, once all the disappointment, disillusionment, you know, notice I mentioned disappointment again, right? I mean, once that, you know, dies away and they kind of just settle in to this benighted state, right? You know, rather than sadness, it's uncertainty. So you have kind of these two different modalities of, you know, kind of depending on your temperament. You know, when it all settles out, you know, and you're sort of just sitting there in the emptiness of yourself, and you're sad, you know, or uncertain. You know, so kind of keep those two in mind as we go forward. And we'll see again. You know, what's the remedy for this emptiness of self, right, that you settle into? You thought you had a great purpose and value and meaning to your life, right? But it was all self imagined, and you're knocked off of that. And then what? You're left with this, you know, self emptiness.
Look how. Between the two, Peter and James, both were, James had emotions of elation and Peter was swept off his feet by the popular manifestation of enthusiasm, but James manifested in the moment a little more reflection at the same time that Peter doesn't seem to show, because James at one time, all of a sudden he's elated, and then he realizes, wait a minute, what's going to happen when we get to the temple? Peter wasn't doing that kind of reflective thinking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We see, you know, they're kind of expected temperamental differentials, right?
Right.
Are you know, in the midst of this, definitely.
Right.
But you notice the contrast, between James and Andrew. I mean, Andrew was just well nigh confused, but James is profoundly confused.
Yeah, along with a little perplexity.
Yeah, right, including perplexity, yeah. Right, thrown in for good measure. Right, so see, it's going much deeper, with Peter and James than it did with Andrew.
Yeah, right.
I was trying to see if somewhere in here they describe James Zebedee as having a temper problem, temper tantrums. At Jesus' final admonition to him is, mind your temper, it could get you killed, which it did, I guess. I'm just wondering, is it those conflicting emotions that can lead people to just in a very stressed out state, and they can just have these, it's a loss of temper because you're kind of divided against yourself.
Yeah.
Wild swings.
Yeah, and you notice that it was distressing, So
right.
He's being torn asunder inside.
Right.
John
Zebedee came somewhere near understanding why Jesus did this. At least he grasped in part the spiritual significance of this so-called triumphal entry into Jerusalem. As the multitude moved on toward the temple, and as John beheld his master sitting there astride the colt, he recalled hearing Jesus one time quote the passage of Scripture, the utterance of Zechariah, which described the coming of the Messiah as a man of peace and riding into Jerusalem on an ass. As John turned this Scripture over in his mind, he began to comprehend the symbolic significance of this Sunday afternoon pageant. At least, he grasped enough of the meaning of this Scripture to enable him somewhat to enjoy the episode and to prevent his becoming overmuch depressed by the apparent purposeless ending of the triumphal procession. John had a type of mind which naturally tended to think and feel in symbols.
Just one little aside, because you see it kind of very overtly here. When we talk about how the midwayers are very much starting with, an understanding and a nomenclature about Jesus' life from the New Testament and 2,000 years of religious scholarship about it, right? I mean, when it says so-called triumphal entry into Jerusalem, I mean, called by whom? So-called by whom, right? I mean, that's the traditional Christian way to refer to this event, the triumphal entry into Jerusalem, right? Just like, each of the parables sorts of has a traditional way they're referred to. The parable
right.
of blank, right?
Right.
And the midwayers are always using that terminology, so they're meeting you where you are. You go, I know that parable. That's exactly what we call that parable. It's like, yeah, that's why they're calling it that. So you see that, the so-called triumphal entry into Jerusalem. And of course, obviously one of the things that they're disabusing us of here is, the degree to which Christianity has gone off on a false tangent with that triumphal word. It's like, well, let's back that up a little bit here, folks. But the interesting thing, about John's temperament, like they mentioned at the end, He had a type of mind which naturally tended to think and feel in symbols. Okay, and so why does that significantly alter how he is processing the event, during the event, as they're describing? Because he has that ability to think more abstractly, that's a whole bit about think and feel in symbols, he can take the story from chapter 9 of Zechariah, and he can abstract verse 9, and it's an immediately related things there. He can abstract that from the rest of the story in chapter 9, which is, very much, kind of Old Testament sort of fashion, talking about the judgment that God is going to rain down on Israel's enemies. Right? If you know that story, right? And that's your kind of basic modality, is to just take it at face value, right? You're not going to be able to abstract like Jesus did and like John is recognizing that Jesus did, right? Abstract, the little vignette, about, coming, to proclaim peace to the nations, as it says in verse 10, right? You're not going to be able to abstract that out, the peace part, from, the God raining judgment down upon Israel's enemies, right? For those of us who are, even remotely familiar with what goes on in Palestine today, you could note that Zechariah was talking about God, raining judgment down upon Gaza. Right? And frequently, right, there's stuff raining down on Gaza these days. Yeah. Right? Nothing has changed since Zechariah. Right, in the minds of those who are still kind of based in that modality. That key of can you think abstractly enough, or are you just too much of a prosaic literalist? Like we've talked about, there's a lot of Christians that can't think abstractly enough to think of the bread and the wine symbolically.
Yeah.
They have to think of it literally as his body and his blood. And anything else is just completely nonsensical to them. It's like, what are you talking about? Right? They're just very simple, literal thinking children of God.
I'm just looking at this paragraph, it sort of stands apart from all the rest. They're not attributing a lot of DIS prefixed words to John. We have to just sort of take it as a general theme that, yes, he was still suffering from this apostle's attitude, but they're holding up something about him that was outstanding rather than something that was particularly deficient in this moment. It's intriguing.
Yeah, and so, Andrew had some tempering influence, like we were saying, and some mitigating influence from the material pragmatism. John has a little bit of stabilizing influence because he had a little nugget of recognition he could hold on to. Right? But, he's one of the sons of thunder, so, there's a whole bunch that they, you could say a number of things about John that it was said about his brother James. Right, but so they didn't have to repeat it, right? Right, they could just say, "See James." okay, but in contrast to James, he had this one little island of stability he could establish in his mind. Right, he could abstract and then focus in on, I see what Jesus was up to there. All right, he was focusing on that sentence about about the Prince of Peace, even though the whole passage is overwhelmingly about raining judgment down on Israel's enemies.
Philip was entirely unsettled by the suddenness and spontaneity of the outburst. He could not collect his thoughts sufficiently while on the way down Olivet to arrive at any settled notion as to what all the demonstration was about. In a way, he enjoyed the performance because his master was being honored. By the time they reached the temple, he was perturbed by the thought that Jesus might possibly ask him to feed the multitude, so that the conduct of Jesus in turning leisurely away from the crowds, which so sorely disappointed the majority of the apostles, was a great relief to Philip. Multitudes had sometimes been a great trial to the steward of the 12. After he was relieved of these personal fears regarding the material needs of the crowds, Philip joined with Peter in the expression of disappointment that nothing was done to teach the multitude. That night, Philip got to thinking over these experiences and was tempted to doubt the whole idea of the kingdom. He honestly wondered what all these things could mean, but he expressed his doubts to no one. He loved Jesus too much. He had great personal faith in the Master. I just want to ask real quick, so this doubt that Philip is experiencing about whether this whole thing is even real, this whole kingdom idea, is that the same doubt that the other ones, when they, they talked several times with the other apostles that they had experienced this doubt, is it the same doubt about the whole kingdom idea or whether Jesus is really what he says he is?
Yeah, I mean, it's going to have different shades, with each of them, but it's basically... Right, they're doubting, their longstanding belief that, like you're saying, kind of basically Jesus is who he says he is, and then this is, significant and consequential, and it's like, well, maybe I've just been, deceiving myself. I mean, they kind of know that you can rationalize anything. It's like, have I just been approaching everything with an incorrect initial assumption and twisting it in my head? And
right.
Think about you're reading this great big tome called the Urantia Book, right? That is addressing just, every subject known to man, basically. And, and on the one hand you go, yes, I firmly believe, but then, there's a part of you that can't firmly believe, right? That's going to try to sneak in there and say, are you sure you just haven't gotten carried away by your emotions and this is all just some clever scheme by someone to deceive you?
Right.
If you've never admitted that voice in your head, I mean, you're still whistling past the graveyard and things. You have to recognize there's a part of you that can never firmly believe that this is the fifth epical revelation of truth to mankind.
Your animal origin self, it's not possible for it to have much of any certitude of the divine. It can't. It's an animal.
Right. Yeah. And so you have to unnaturally overrule that, right? And until you were literally doing that, you were overruling that. I mean, you haven't even begun to use your personality in any mode of self-control. Right? Like I said, you're still in some primitive sort of self-denial thing. I'm going to pretend that doesn't exist, right? And then I'm just pure of heart, It's like, no, I see you have your eyes closed and your fingers in your ears and you're humming, right? We need to get above ourselves and get control of that. I mean, we can't change the fact that there's a part of us that can't believe. Um, You know, but do notice that, you don't want to overplay the second time they say doubts, right? I mean, he was tempted to doubt. Okay, so
yeah.
They are indicating, see, that Philip isn't going as deep into doubting, right? He's playing on the threshold, right? And he didn't express the fact that he was playing on the threshold of doubting, you know, to anyone. But, you know, they just told you point blank, Andrew was doubting. So, you know, serious doubts, or troubled with serious doubts, you know, is the statement. Okay, so Philip is doing better than Andrew in that regard. And in Philip's case, it's similar to Andrew. He has a material pragmatism issue that he's identified very strongly to that is tempering his mind from getting, you know, up to too high a speed and running way off.
Right. I was going to mention that. Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, he's right there with Peter with the disappointment. Okay. Yeah. So again, like we've been saying, they all, you know, are in this disappointment, disillusionment, you know, in different ways, one way or another, you know, in the immediacy. But as that fades, you know, into the late evening. Okay, we saw that Peter was left in sadness. James was left in uncertainty. Oh, but look at what Philip found. Philip found the cure to that self-darkness. Faith.
Personal faith in the Master.
And
yeah.
Literally, remember, faith is believing God's promises and following his instructions. Okay, so take those two things in that order and match them up. What is the cure for sadness? Believing God's promises. What's the cure for uncertainty? Following his instructions. I don't know what to do. Follow his instructions.
Yeah.
See? Sadness and uncertainty. The answer is faith. Believe God's promises and follow his instructions.
Nathaniel, aside from the symbolic and prophetic aspects, came the nearest to understanding the Master's reason for enlisting the popular support of the Passover pilgrims. He reasoned it out before they reached the temple, that without such a demonstrative entry into Jerusalem, Jesus would have been arrested by the Sanhedrin officials and cast into a prison the moment he presumed to enter the city. He was not, therefore, in the least surprised that the Master made no further use of the cheering crowds when he had once got inside the walls of the city and had thus so forcibly impressed the Jewish leaders that they would refrain from placing him under immediate arrest. Understanding the real reason for the Master's entering the city in this manner, Nathanael naturally followed along with more poise and was less perturbed and disappointed by Jesus' subsequent contact than were the other apostles. Nathanael had great confidence in Jesus' understanding of men, as well as in his sagacity and cleverness in handling difficult situations.
So, not only the faith directly, but that which is with faith, confidence, right? The literalness of the word confidence right there. Daniel
yeah.
had great confidence. He had that which is with faith. And look at what a useful companion the other side of the pair is with faith, right? I mean, reason and faith are those parallel elements, foundational elements. Nathanael has the reason, right, to go along with his faith.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so he that reason helped his issue of faith, helped to maintain the faith that the others were, you know, had sort of lost and had to reestablish. Right, they just fall down into this self-emptiness. right, and have to reach up again in faith. But yeah, look at how effective it was to have a little bit of a companion of reason for that faith. He naturally followed along with more poise and was less perturbed and disappointed. He's still, I mean, they're all disappointed and disillusioned to some degree.
Yeah, the section starts out with that. Yeah, there's one attitude. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. I mean, but all of their temperamental differences and whatnot, and that to which they'd taken delight in cultivating, you might say, right, is helping them, in various ways, to get through this situation.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and even mentioning sagacity, right, so that, it's not just wisdom, it's the insight and foresight. Nathaniel appreciated, reason, genuine reason begins with the insight of an initial assumption. It begins with definitive point from the first cosmic intuition. Right? And see, and that's a companion to a definitive point with the third cosmic intuition, with faith.
Huh. I'm going to have to listen to that again.
All right. Those two being side, thinking of them as side by side. Good boy, Nathaniel. You can see, why the master might have, at times taken Nathaniel aside and just talked to him. It's like, okay, you can handle this, Nathaniel. The others, not so much.
Right.
Matthew was at first nonplussed by this pageant performance. He did not grasp the meaning of what his eyes were seeing until he also recalled the scripture in Zechariah where the prophet had alluded to the rejoicing of Jerusalem because her king had come bringing salvation and riding upon the colt of an ass. As the procession moved in the direction of the city and then drew on toward the temple, Matthew became ecstatic. He was certain that something extraordinary would happen when the master arrived at the temple at the head of this shouting multitude. When one of the Pharisees mocked Jesus, saying, "Look, everybody, see who comes here, the king of the Jews riding on an ass," Matthew kept his hands off of him only by exercising great restraint. None of the 12 was more depressed on the way back to Bethany that evening. Next to Simon Peter and Simon Zelotes, he experienced the highest nervous tension and was in a state of exhaustion by night. But by morning, Matthew was much cheered. He was, after all, a cheerful loser.
and if you can't sort of like do that supreme upward grasp of faith to pull yourself out of your self-darkness, you can just have a temperament that goes, it's a little bit Alpheus twins, like, let's go. So Matthew was kind of, moved forward by that temperament there. But see, notice the contrast here between Matthew and John. I see, so they mentioned they both went, wait a minute. We all know how much Matthew knows the Old Testament. That's why the Gospel of Matthew is the way it is, right? He goes, wait a minute, Zechariah 9:9. I get that. But notice the difference. He couldn't abstract, right, that little element out of the bigger context. And so he's very much expecting the rest of the story.
Yeah.
Right, that God is going to rain down judgment. He's very disillusioned by that. None of the 12 was more depressed.
but then good the next day. Nothing like a good night's sleep.
Yeah, ignorance is bliss. Is that, did something happen
yeah.
yesterday? I don't remember anything. Let's go.
That's funny.
Yeah. Sometimes, see, again, it's handy to kind of just be a fancy animal. You know, you don't get a hold of yourself and just, to, you know, it's one thing to be pulled down like he was, but, you know, to hold yourself down because your will is, you know, in play. And see, you know, he didn't have that, so, you know, he kind of just bounced right back up. You know, there's a spring at the bottom of the elevator shaft, and he bounced off of it.
Oh, that's funny. I'm a little bit like that, too. I remember when my kids were little, and I'd be upset with them about something, and I'd have to write myself a note. Hey, make sure you remember to be mad at Dan in the morning because, you know, he screwed up last night. Otherwise, it was gone. Otherwise, it was a new day, you know? Who cares?
The birds are singing, the sun is shining, the sky is blue. It's a Disney movie.
No, you're still mad. Remember that. Okay, here we go. Thomas was the most bewildered and puzzled man of all the 12. Most of the time, he just followed along, gazing at the spectacle and honestly wondering what could be the master's motive for participating in such a peculiar demonstration. Down deep in his heart, he regarded the whole performance as a little childish, if not downright foolish. He had never seen Jesus do anything like this and was at a loss to account for his strange conduct on this Sunday afternoon. By the time they reached the temple, Thomas had deduced that the purpose of this popular demonstration was so to frighten the Sanhedrin that they would not dare immediately to arrest the master. On the way back to Bethany, Thomas thought much but said nothing. By bedtime, the master's cleverness in staging the tumultuous entry into Jerusalem had begun to make a somewhat humorous appeal, and he was much cheered up by this reaction.
Again, notice his parallel to Nathaniel. He did actually have the reason, mm-hmm. right, is helping him out here. You know, and
yeah.
eventually when it sinks in, you know, he's delighting in, you know, in the intricate cleverness of the scientific thing that Jesus did in manipulating
yeah.
the situation, see?
And yeah. he's got one of those minds. He's got to make sense
yeah.
of it.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah, so as you'd expect, there's going to be some similarities between Thomas and Nathaniel. Yeah, but we know there's temperamental differences there. But nonetheless, you know, you can see the similarities. And again, it's, you know, the reason is helping the faith. Right? They're working hand in hand, side by side. Right? And it's a very great lesson for everyone. Right? Take delight in cultivating, being able to have some reason. Right, and so your reason and your faith can hold hands and work side by side together.
This Sunday
like
started
it.
Off as, oh, go ahead.
Go ahead.
This Sunday started off as a great day for Simon Zelotes. He saw visions of wonderful doings in Jerusalem the next few days, and in that he was right. But Simon dreamed of the establishment of the new national rule of the Jews, with Jesus on the throne of David. Simon saw the nationalists springing into action as soon as the kingdom was announced, and himself in supreme command of the assembling military forces of the new kingdom. On the way down Olivet, he even envisaged the Sanhedrin and all their sympathizers dead before sunset of that day. He really believed something great was going to happen. He was the noisiest man in the whole multitude. By 5 o'clock that afternoon, he was a silent, crushed, and disillusioned apostle. He never fully recovered from the depression which settled down on him as a result of this day's shock, at least not until long after the master's resurrection.
Wow. Goodness.
Yeah,
sake.
See, the, you know, the higher, you know, you go up, the farther you fall. I mean, you know, notice they literally said supreme command. You know, you've got the literalness of Jewish supremacy, right?
Yeah.
You know, is the sugar plums dancing in his head? You know, visions of sugar plums were dancing in his head there. As we all know, right? No one had the literalness of Jewish supremacy more definitively in their head than Simon Zelotes. There continues to be that strain to this day, right? And lots of people fear that boogeyman. So you see that, the disappointment there, here you're directly mentioning disillusioned. They all need faith, and as they're pointing out in Simon's case, because he's so, focused on material things, it says at least not until long after the Master's resurrection, right? I mean, he has to have that literal thing to kind of leverage off of to reassert his faith.
Yeah.
Well, I know we don't have time to compare all of this stuff, obviously, with the final admonitions to the apostles, but it's noteworthy. Jesus' final admonition to Simon Zelotes basically boiled down to distinguish the kingdoms of men from the kingdom of heaven, Simon, because you don't, but you ought to.
And, to those that still, have concerns about, the strains of Jewish supremacy because of their sort of biblical, anchoring, the fifth epical revelation has good news for you, that can calm your fears. The Most High's rule in the kingdoms of men.
Yeah.
Not the Jews.
Right.
Yeah, or anyone else, for that matter.
To the Alpheus twins, this was a perfect day. They really enjoyed it all the way through, and not being present during the time of quiet visitation about the temple, they escaped much of the anticlimax of the popular upheaval. They could not possibly understand the downcast behavior of the apostles when they came back to Bethany that evening. In the memory of the twins, this was always their day of being nearest heaven on earth. This day was the satisfying climax of their whole career as apostles, and the memory of the elation of this Sunday afternoon carried them on through all of the tragedy of this eventful week, right up to the hour of the crucifixion. It was the most befitting entry of the king the twins could conceive. They enjoyed every moment of the whole pageant. They fully approved of all they saw and long cherished the memory.
Confused,
yes.
Very, important element there. It was the most befitting entry of the king. See, so they couldn't really think beyond that king idea, but they also couldn't imagine very fancy, relative to kingship. And so this was, this was everything they could imagine about, fulfilling their preconceived opinions of, the king. But you can't help but seeing them, skipping along, as they're, marching towards Jerusalem, casting daisies about, and they're having a grand old time. The Alpheus twins are always a humbling delight, right? as we always stress when we get to the Alpheus twins. There's a very important lesson for everyone in them, right? I mean, there should be a part of you that's like them.
Yeah.
Don't look down your nose at them.
Yeah.
there's a reason they're part of the 12.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
I was going to say, this paragraph actually, for some reason, evokes a little bit of Don Quixote, Miguel de Cervantes, just that very simple idealism. He's riding in on a donkey. Like, of course, he's a king. It has that, for the same reason that novel is charming to us, because some part of us wants to be that idealistic and simplistic about the world. Anyway, I like that novel, too. So.
Yeah, that's a good. That's a great point. Yes.
Okay. Of all the apostles, Judas Iscariot was the most adversely affected by this processional entry into Jerusalem. His mind was in a disagreeable ferment because of the master's rebuke the preceding day in connection with Mary's anointing at the feast in Simon's house. Judas was disgusted with the whole spectacle. To him, it seemed childish, if not indeed ridiculous. As this vengeful apostle looked upon the proceedings of this Sunday afternoon, Jesus seemed to him more to resemble a clown than a king. He heartily resented the whole performance. He shared the views of the Greeks and Romans, who looked down upon anyone who would consent to ride upon an ass or the colt of an ass. By the time the triumphal procession had entered the city, Judas had about made up his mind to abandon the whole idea of such a kingdom. He was almost resolved to forsake all such farcical attempts to establish the kingdom of heaven. And then he thought of the resurrection of Lazarus and many other things and decided to stay on with the 12 at least for another day. Besides, he carried the bag and he would not desert with the apostolic funds in his possession. On the way back to Bethany that night, his conduct did not seem strange, since all the apostles were equally downcast and silent. I wonder if Judas thought, oh, they all feel like I do.
Yeah, I mean, and to a degree, yes, they did. So that's the point they're making there. You know, and notice, you know, what an effort the midwayers make, like we always do when we talk about Judas. Okay, don't paint him with a simple dichotomy brush here. I mean, you know, he's definitely, has a more disrupted upper domain than any of them. And this, like I said, this is very much, you know, breaking things up there. But, you know, notice how much integrity he still has. Right? I mean, this isn't, you know, some completely dark, iniquitous person we're talking about here. Right? You know, he immediately was pulling himself back even. Right?
Right.
You know, and then on top of it, you've got the material pragmatism thing, and his third adjutant, his energy of loyalty, right, is helping. Besides, he carried the bag, and he would not desert with the apostolic funds in his possession. Right? I mean, just, you know, think about how much integrity he has compared to an awful lot of people around us today. And yet he gets infinitely demonized. However, right, I mean, he, you know, as I was just saying, he is definitely, you know, you notice another dis word, disagreeable, and ferment, right? I mean, like I said, he's, you know, it's boiling, right? It's very agitated. You know, in other words, it's, you know, when you project that upward with your sixth adjutant, you know, it's introducing even less of a cosmic unity up there, a more and more narrowly self-based cosmic unity, which is disrupting of your relationship to the transcendent wholeness, transcendent of all parts, things and beings, whole, you know, unity of the cosmos.
Yeah.
So, and just one other thing. Notice how Judas has some very similar, you know, mentality to, he's reacting the same way, you know, and thinking of this as like, well, this isn't grandiose religiosity. You know, this is a farce.
He's got some
similarities to Thomas there, you know, as well.
Judas was tremendously influenced by the ridicule of his Sadducean friends, No other single factor exerted such a powerful influence on him. In his final determination to forsake Jesus and his fellow apostles, as a certain episode which occurred just as Jesus reached the gate of the city. A prominent Sadducee, a friend of Judas's family, rushed up to him in a spirit of gleeful ridicule and, slapping him on the back, said, "Why so troubled of countenance, my good friend? Cheer up and join us all while we acclaim this Jesus of Nazareth, the King of the Jews, as he rides through the gates of Jerusalem seated on an ass." Judas had never shrunk from persecution, but he could not stand this sort of ridicule. With the long-nourished emotion of revenge, there was now blended this fatal fear of ridicule, that terrible and fearful feeling of being ashamed of his master and his fellow apostles. At heart, this ordained ambassador of the kingdom was already a deserter. It only remained for him to find some plausible excuse for an open break with the master.
Notice the wording there, with the long and nourished emotion of revenge that was now blended, this fatal fear of ridicule. See, so again, think about, the blending thing. You're establishing this self-based unity in the upper domain. Right? That's why, you're thinking of homogenizing, blending. See, so you have a continuumness, right, that based upon an ever smaller self-concept.
Yeah.
Right? That's been exalted into the continuumness. And then that last part, right, is very much at heart. And see, again, see, so he's spiritualizing this stuff like I was just saying, right? And your will is up there. And notice that really all they're saying there in that final sentence is, at heart, where there's a will, and then when they say, it only remained for him to find some plausible, there's a way.
Yeah.
Right.
Because the upper domain is dominant over the lower domain. Right? You can, where there's a will, there's a way. Right? To finagle the lower domain into some clever, state where you can convince yourself that this is appropriate. Right? He has to overcome, like we said, all these things that, are clearly, tempering him going that direction. Right? But he's got to find a clever path through all that, and where there's a will, there's a way.
Right.
It's a small, minor point, but in between the lines, there's probably a pretty good argument for not having an only child. Like, you could get rid of this form of ridicule if you've got a brother or a sister, and you just fight it out a little bit as kids. But he grew up with this kind of stuff, and now he can't stand it.
Yeah, and you notice I mentioned he never shrunk from persecution. Again, he has some spiritual strength.
Yeah.
Right, but he's got these Achilles heels, and he's making that his cosmos, right, rather than the cosmos.
Yeah.
All right, well, that brings us down to our last minute here. It was as excellent of a study as I imagined it would be. It was sort of a little miniature paper 139, which is certainly a lot of people's one of their favorites. I certainly enjoyed this a great deal. Plenty to think about, and a fine example of how to deepen one's reflective study of this epical revelation. We'll see you here next week, we hope, folks. Until then, do your best to follow the way.
God bless everyone.
Good night, everyone.
And if doing your best isn't adequate, God can help you to do better. Believe God's promises and follow His instructions. Right? As we learn tonight, faith is the salvation from all of these little spheres of self darkness. So lift yourself up. Take care, everyone.